Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Happy to be here today on the 2nd of June, 8:30 p.m. at Ling's house in KL. Supposed to be a talk or a discussion. And since Rob is an Abhidhamma teacher, maybe we'll talk something about Abhidhamma. All of you have heard of Abhidhamma, right? What do you think Abhidhamma is? Some people say that Abhidhamma is not the word of the Buddha. Have you heard that?
Yes.
Do you think it's the word of the Buddha? Rob came to see me on the 31st, that was 2 days ago, and he said that he's been reading or studying the Pali Abhidhamma, which means the seven books of the Abhidhamma, not in the Pali language, but translations. And he found that what is contained in those seven books, or in the books that he has studied, are quite different from what you learn in the Abhidhammata Sangaha. Have you studied the seven books before?
No.
The Abhidhammata Sangaha was actually composed after the Visuddhimagga. When I was in Burma, in the early 90s, I started to study the Visuddhimagga in Pali language. Earlier on, before I went to Burma, when I was a young renunciant as a Samanera, I went through part of the Visuddhimagga in English, the one that all of you would have read, The Path of Purification by Nyanamoli, published by BPS, a very thick volume in English. And when I studied the Pali version, it was so refreshing. Because when you study the English, the sentences are so long that you have a very tough time trying to figure out what the author is trying to say. When you study it in Pali, the sentences are short because the words are short. One Pali word will need a string of English words to explain it. And when you connect one sentence together, it means one whole paragraph. And it's very difficult to navigate to get the meaning of what it's all about. But when you read the Visuddhimagga in Pali, it's so refreshing because it's so simple in terms of sentence construction. It was okay for the first part, Sila Visuddhi. And when it comes to the Samatha concentration, it's still not that bad. But when it comes to Panyabhumi, or the section on the field of wisdom, then things get a bit harder. And I found that in order to understand what the Visuddhimagga is talking about, you have to first of all master the Abhidhammata Sangaha. You know what that is, don't you? If you are Abhidhamma students, you would know what the Abhidhammata Sangaha is. Is a compendium of the Abhidhamma, supposed to have been written by Venerable Anuruddha, and it comes after Visuddhimagga. That's why, when you read the Visuddhimagga, although they use similar concepts and refer to similar mental states, the terminology is different. So in order to be able to understand what the Visuddhimagga is talking about, you have to be really very conversant with the Abhidhammata Sangaha. Understand not only the terminology, but what it really means, and the mental states and the physical phenomena that are referred to. You've got to know the whole structure of the Abhidhammata Sangaha before you can understand what the Visuddhimagga is trying to say. Particularly when they talk about mental states during deep concentration, and also other physical phenomena. Because they always refer back to kalapas and the thought process, cittaviti, the process of how consciousness occurs and how they link together in a cognitive process, for example. But it's interesting to see that although the Abhidhammata Sangaha was composed after the Visuddhimagga, they share the same concepts and they are structurally the same. Why is that so? When we study the Visuddhimagga and we compare the concepts that are dealt with the suttas, sometimes we find quite a lot of discrepancies. What the suttas tell us seem to be quite different from what the Visuddhimagga or the commentaries tell us. The history of the Visuddhimagga is like that. At that time in Ceylon, in Sri Lanka, there were three main Theravada sects. One is called the Mahavihara, and the other is called Jetavana, and another is called Abhayagiri. They were rival Theravada sects. And depending on royal patronage, one sect would be more popular than the other. So at one time, when Mahavihara sect was under royal patronage, the elders of Mahavihara managed to convince the king that the scriptures and the ideas of Abhayagiri sect and Jetavana sect were all heresy, and their books have to be burnt. So the king followed the advice of the elders and burned up all the books. So now we don't have any more variant readings of Theravada scriptures because they've all been burnt. So what survives now is only one Theravada sect based on the Mahavihara. It seems that Venerable Buddha Ghosa was not a Sri Lankan, he came from India. Now which part of India is a bit debatable. Some Burmese historians even claim that Buddha Ghosa was a Burmese. Anyway, he came from India over to Sri Lanka and he stayed in Mahavihara for some time, studying the texts and studying the oral tradition of the elders there. It seems that at that time, only the Pali Canon was in Pali, whereas the commentaries were written in Sinhalese. So Venerable Buddha Ghosa at that time made a request to the elders there to enable him to translate the Sinhalese commentaries into Pali, so that non-Sinhalese Buddhist Theravadin monks can benefit. Of course, the Mahavihara elders have their own quality control, and they wanted to test whether Venerable Buddha Ghosa is actually qualified to translate the Sinhalese commentaries into Pali. Because if he were not skillful enough, he could misinterpret their own ideas. So they put in the test, and it seems that the Visuddhimagga was the first text that he composed and he submitted to the elders of the Mahavihara like an entrance examination. And he passed with flying colors. They were very impressed with his presentation and all the views that he expressed, all the commentaries that he expressed in the Visuddhimagga is representative of the Mahavihara elders' view. In fact, when you read the suttas, sometimes the commentary to any particular sutta is no longer given in detail. You will be referred to Visuddhimagga. It says there in Visuddhimagga, I've already given an explanation for this term. Please refer back. In fact, the Visuddhimagga is considered to be a comprehensive commentary to the five Nikayas. It's all found inside there. Whereas more details are to be found in the individual commentaries to the suttas. So, when the scholar monks of that time studied the suttas, they found that there were many apparent inconsistencies. The Buddha would say one thing in one sutta, and he would say another thing to another sutta. And of course, they would try to figure out how is it that it can be contradictory? Because the Buddha is supposed to be omniscient, he's supposed to be perfect in vision, and there's no way that he can be wrong. The reason why there is this apparent contradiction is because the Buddha preached according to individual tendencies, individual dispositions, preferences, and so forth. The Buddha did not preach an ism. To quote from Christmas Humphreys, who was the founder of the Buddhist Society in UK, he said the Buddha did not preach Buddhism. He taught the truth. He did not teach Buddhism. In fact, what the Buddha taught in each discourse was complete in itself. He would tailor his discourse to a particular individual or to a particular audience. Because he had the omniscience or sabbanuttanjana, he could know what a particular person needed at a particular time, or the people in a particular audience, what they were ready for. So he would tailor his discourse to suit them, and invariably that would mean there would be differences and there would be apparent contradictions. Saying one thing to one person may not be suitable to another, so he would put it in another way. To some, he would say that you should start off with sila, and then you go on to samadhi, and then you go on to panya. For some people, he don't talk about sila. He starts straight away from samadhi, and he go to panya. For some people, he didn't even start from samadhi. He would just talk about the paticca-samuppada, and that person would get enlightened while listening to the talk. For some people, he would say, no, well, you have to become a monk, or you have to go through the gradual training, the 8-step process, going through perfection of sila, going to guarding the doors of the senses, then practicing moderation in eating, practicing wakefulness, practicing satisambhajana, which is mindfulness and full comprehension, then to go to a secluded place, try to overcome your 5 hindrances, and then after that, attain the jhanas before going further into vipassana. For some people like Malukyaputta, the old monk, he gave him very brief instructions. He just said, Malukya, in whatever that you see, there must just be the seen. Whatever you hear, it must just be the heard. Whatever you feel, there must only be what is felt. Whatever you perceive, there must only be the perceived. And there was a very short instruction he gave to Malukyaputta. Malukyaputta received the instruction, carried it out, and became an arahant. He didn't talk about sila, he didn't talk about this gradual training. These apparent contradictions pose a big problem for scholars when we try to systematize the Buddha's teachings. Nowadays, we have management manuals. They will tell you from A to Z, introduction, and then they will give you a course outline, and then after that, subheadings for each chapter. The Buddha didn't do that. Every discourse was complete by itself. That discourse was enough to enlighten a particular person if he was ready for it. So what the early commentators or the Theras did was they tried to unravel this based on the assumption that the Buddha, of course, is sabbanuttā, perfectly self-enlightened, omniscient one. There's no way that he can be wrong. So any apparent contradictions are only apparent, they are not real. So we have to find a way to reconcile all these things. And so they came out with the Abhidhamma model. They came out with this model of the 17 thought moments to complete a cittavritti, a cognitive process. For your information, these 17 thought moments cannot be found in the original, or so-called original, Abhidhamma Pali text. In the 7 books, nothing is mentioned about these 17 thought moments. This came even much later. It was already there when Buddha Gosa was staying in Mahavihara, and it was the prevalent view among the elders there. That was the way they used to explain all these apparent contradictions in the scriptures. They made use of this Abhidhamma model of these 17 thought moments as a basis to explain all phenomena, mental as well as physical phenomena. Even physical phenomena is explained in terms of the 17 thought moments, because what is the lifespan of physical phenomena? 17 thought moments, right? 17 thought moments is the lifespan of a kalapa. So that is the reference point for them. And incidentally, from the Abhidhamma point of view, from the commentarial point of view, they say that the Magapala that we talk about, path and fruition, are actually referring to the thought moment. And the fruition thought moment follows immediately after the Magga, without any gap in between. This has some contradictions in the suttas, because in the suttas, or rather when you chant Idipiso or Supadipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho, you talk about the four pairs of individuals, you know, the eight types of individuals. And also in some suttas, the Buddha talk about people who are on the path and people who have realized the fruition. They seem to be separate types of individual, and they don't happen in one thought moment. People might be on a path for several years before they go on to the fruition. This is an inconsistency that has been pointed out by Pali scholars. This is one instance of how there seems to be an inconsistency in the way this Abhidhamma model works. It does not seem to fit in with what the suttas tell us. Another instance is that of rebirth. According to the Abhidhamma model, after death consciousness follows rebirth, linking consciousness, or patisandhicitta, immediately without any gap in between. This also cannot be found in the suttas. In fact, there are several suttas where the Buddha talked about an intermediate being, but he did not really specify how many days. Maybe Chinese believe in the seven sevens, 49 days. That seems to be something that came from the Tibetan book, Bardo Todol, from the Tibetan tradition. Usually translated as Tibetan Book of the Dead, but that's not the actual translation. Bardo means a gap in between. Todol means liberation through hearing. So the actual title of the book is The Great Liberation Through Hearing and the Gap in Between. So this came from the Tibetan tradition. It didn't come from our Pali tradition. To give you an instance, in the suttas where this intermediate being is implied, the Buddha talked of his birth in Tusita heaven before coming down to human plane in his last rebirth. He would describe his descent onto earth this way. He says, Tusita kaya cavitva. After having deceased from the Tusita body, the Bodhisatta, Sato Sambajano, mindful and fully aware, Matu Kuching Okami. Matu Kuching means into the mother's womb, Okami, he enters. Let us look at this sentence. Having deceased from the Tusita body, the Bodhisatta, mindful and fully aware, entered the mother's womb. Don't you think that there's an implication that there's something in there? If it were just one death consciousness followed immediately by rebirth linking consciousness, there's no necessity to be mindful and fully aware. Right or not? There's another reference in another sutta where the Buddha talked about certain types of beings. Some beings, they enter the womb fully aware, they stay there fully aware, and they come out fully aware. Some beings, they enter aware, stay in there unaware, come out unaware. Some beings, they go in unknowingly, and then they stay there unknowingly, and they come out knowingly. Some beings go in unknowingly, stay in unknowingly, come out unknowingly. I think they're most averse here. So here also you can see that there is an indication of it. In another sutta, in the Mahatana Sankhya Sutta, the Buddha talks about human conception, how it happens. He says when the mother is in season, and then the mother and father are in union, and there is a Gandhabha, a being to be born. Then only conception can occur. Otherwise, there's no conception. Now, what is this Gandharva? In Mahadana Sankhya Sutta, he did not state what Gandharva was. But in another sutta, in Astalayana Sutta, one Brahmin was asking the Buddha about the purity of a Brahmin. The Brahmins are very particular. They claim that they are the descendants of Brahma. And then the Buddha was cross-questioning this Brahmin and asking him, how do you know that you are pure? How do you know that your parents are pure Brahmins? How do you know that there was no big blood before? Then he asked about conception. How about the time of conception? What happens? So it seems that at that time, it was really a generally accepted idea that these factors are involved. That the mother is in season, the parents are in union, and then there is a Gandharva. Because this Brahmin said the same thing. He said, these three things must be there. Then the Buddha asked him, how do you know what caste the Gandharva belongs to? Is he a Brahmin, or is he a Kshatriya, or is he a Sudra? Then the Brahmin says, we don't know. In that case, how can you be sure that you are pure descendants of the Brahma? So we can see here that the Gandharva is also a being, although it's not classified under the 32 planes of existence. This is another instance where there seems to be a contradiction with the Abhidhamma model of reality and what the Buddha actually preached. Yesterday, I was just reading through the commentary to the Abhidhamma Pitaka, just to refresh my memory, because I was going to come and give you a talk and a discussion here. Even at the time when Venerable Buddha Gosa translated the Abhidhamma commentary from Sinhalese into Pali, there was already a controversy among monks. In the introduction to the commentary to the Abhidhamma Pitaka, there is a dialogue or an argument, a debate between two monks. One monk says, what are you doing? Why are you reciting all this? This is not Buddha Vachana. This is not the word of the Buddha. And then the other monk said that it is the word of the Buddha. So they were having an argument about who is right and who is wrong. One of the arguments was that the suttas will start off with, thus have I heard. The Buddha at one time was staying in Chetavana, Anathapindika's monastery near Sarvati. But in Abhidhamma Pitaka, nothing is mentioned. You start off with kusala, dhamma, akusala, dhamma, just like that. So how do you know that this is what the Buddha said? Where did this come from? And so then, the legend of the Buddha delivering this Abhidhamma in Tavatinsa heaven for his previous mother evolved from there. So people said, yeah, there is an introduction, it's just not put there. The introduction was, thus have I heard. At one time, the Buddha was staying in Tavatinsa and sitting on Sakka's throne and giving this talk to the mother. So after that, there was a long story. They went through that argument, and towards the end of it, they asked, okay, where was this talk given? It was given in Tavatinsa. To whom was it given? It was given to the Devas, and so forth, and all this catechism. So it's interesting to see that, according to the legend, the Buddha actually delivered the Abhidhamma to Devas, not to human beings. So why are you studying? You want to do a pre-deva course, is it? You study first so that when you become a deva, you can get enlightened faster. Another interesting thing is that I was trying to find out this legend in the commentary yesterday. I couldn't find the second part. The first part I found that it was given the devas. According to the second part of the legend is that the reason why the Buddha gave the Abhidhamma to the devas was because the whole of the Abhidhamma, though of the seven books, was designed so that when one goes through the whole course in one sitting, one can get enlightened. How many months have you studied?
How many years?
So the reason why he did that in the Deva realm was because the time there is different from us. According to legend, he stayed there for 3 months for the rainy season retreat to preach the Abhidhamma. Now, according to Tava Tingsa time and our time, the difference is what is 3 months to us is less than 3 minutes to them. And he finished everything in one sitting so that the thousands and millions of devas got enlightened. Some of them became Sotapan and Arahan and so forth. So that's the legend. So again, if the legend is true, then why are you studying Abhidhamma? You're going to take more than one sitting, definitely. So it's actually just a pre-deva course that you're taking, so that when you go to the deva land, you can get enlightened faster. Now, it seems that the Buddha was up there preaching the Abhidhamma for 3 months. But because he had this physical human body, he had to give food to it. He cannot just stay there for 3 months without eating. So every day he would come down for alms round. He would come down to a certain lake and Venerable Sariputta will get alms for him and then prepare his two stick and so forth and wash his bowl. At that time, the Buddha would give the gist of what he preached for that session to Venerable Sariputta. So Venerable Sariputta, being the greatest disciple in terms of wisdom, was able to fathom what the Buddha said, even though he just gave a brief explanation, and expand on it by teaching his students. So every few milliseconds, he would come down. But up there, he created an image of himself who was giving the talk. So physically he was here, but up there is just a nimitta. It's just a creation of his. So the legend goes. Now, Venerable Sariputta, after he had learned from the Buddha, would teach his disciples. It seems that his disciples, whom he taught, were exceptional people. They had done a pre-Abhidhamma course before in the past life. In the past life, they were bats. There were bats hanging on a cave during Kassapa Buddha's time. And in the cave, there were these monks who were reciting the Abhidhamma. So every day, they would recite the Abhidhamma. If you don't recite the Abhidhamma, you'll forget. At one time, I could remember the whole of the Abhidhammata Sangaha by heart. Now you ask me, I cannot remember already because I stopped reciting for a long time. So they were reciting this in a cave, and these bats were just hanging there and then listening. You know, they don't understand a single word, but maybe they like the chanting and they sort of were very pleased with it. And then they died. After they died, they were reborn in heaven because they listened to the Dhamma, even though they didn't understand. After they deceased from the Deva realm, they came back as human beings. And then they became Venerable Sariputta's disciples and they were able to receive the Abhidhamma teachings and understand them. But there was no mention of them getting enlightened because they studied the Abhidhamma teaching. In fact, there's no instance in the scriptures, even in the commentaries, of people getting enlightened because they studied Abhidhamma. But in the introduction to the Abhidhamma commentary, there is a mention of a Thera who reflected on the Patthana, the last book, on his greatness. And then when there was a lot of joy that arose in him, he made use of the joy, watched the joy, made use of the Satipatthana, observed the joy, watched it arising and passing away, and then he became enlightened. As an Arahant, he became liberated as he was crossing the sea from Sri Lanka to India. This is a commentarial story. So, that is a legend of how the Abhidhamma came about. And they had to create this legend in order to justify it because they cannot find it in the suttas. And this is very, very reminiscent of what the non-Theravadins are doing. They also have a lot of suttas which we don't have, and they always start with, "Thus have I heard." The Buddha was staying there, and the Buddha held up a rose, and then Moggallana looked and smiled. Have you heard that before? If you are studying the Pali scriptures from a very objective point of view, you can find the beginnings of Mahayana Buddhism inside Theravada itself. When I was reading through the introduction to the Abhidhamma commentary, Buddhaghosa, as a translator, gave a very lengthy account of how Abhidhamma talks came about. He went back not just to the time when the Buddha got enlightened. It seems that after the Buddha got enlightened, when he was spending the first seven weeks enjoying the fruits of his enunciation, like one of the 7 weeks, he was contemplating on the conditional relationships. And then all this aura emanated from his body, and there's also another commentarial tradition. They didn't start from there. They went back until Sumedha's time. You know Sumedha? Sumedha was the ascetic who made the vow to become a Sammasambuddha during Dipankara Buddha's time. That was the starting point of Gautama Buddha's career way back in the past. Now, when you look at the Sutta Pitaka, the Buddha only mentioned 7 Buddhas. 4 from this kappa, and 3 more in the previous kappas. And only one sutta, he mentioned Maitreya Buddha, the future Buddha for this kappa. In a later text, which has been canonized, called the Cariya Pitaka and the Buddha Vamsa, the two texts, they go back until Dipankara Buddha. So they try to establish a lineage of Buddhas from where our Buddha stopped, from the 7th, and then they went way back until 28th, until Dipankara Buddha. So in the introduction to the commentary to the Abhidhamma Pitaka, they went back right until the beginning, until Sumedha's time. And they started and quoted all the verses from the so-called canonical text. Because the Buddha Vamsa and Cariya Pitaka are also supposed to be part of the Pali Canon, is found in the Khudaka Nikaya, the 5th Nikaya. But if you study the earlier Nikayas, the Digha Nikaya, the Majjhima Nikaya, Samyutta Nikaya, Anguttara Nikaya, these 4 early Nikayas, you will find that the concept of Parami cannot be found. It's not found at all in the early 4 Nikayas. And even in the earlier books of the Khudaka Nikaya, nothing is found. According to the commentaries, they recognize that there are 15 books in the Khudaka Nikaya. But now in the Burmese edition of the Tipitaka, they have 20 books. They included other books into the Khudaka Nikaya. So now it's growing. Just like the Mahayana texts are also growing. They are growing more and more. Right, so out of the Khudaka Nikaya, you have the texts like Udana, Iti Vuttaka, Sutta Nipata, and Jatakas. These 4 texts are actually mentioned by the Buddha in his 9-fold classification of the Dhamma. In the early Nikayas, in the suttas, when the Buddha talks about the Dhamma, he would categorize the Dhamma into 9 types. And of these, Sutta Nipata is included, Iti Vuttaka is included, Udana is included, and Jataka also included. Jataka means the verses only, not the whole story. The whole story is all commentarial legend. So even in these early books, in the Udana, in the Iti Vuttaka, Sutta Nipata, Jataka, nothing is mentioned about Paramis. Nothing is mentioned about Bodhisattva also. In fact, when we were in Sri Lanka, we got a book. Someone made a comparative study of the Majjhima Nikaya and the Madhyamaka Agama, the Chinese equivalent of the Majjhima Nikaya. And Venerable Kumara pointed out to me that the word Bodhisattva cannot be found in the Chinese Agama, but it's found in our Majjhima Nikaya. So, what does that mean? The implication is that the Chinese Agama were actually earlier than Pali Nikaya, the Majjhima Nikaya in particular, went through some additions. People edited and put in things. The concept of Parami came much later. In fact, Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi wrote a book called The Treatise on Paramis, based on a commentarial work in Pali. And he made some comparative study, and he says that these are actually based on a Sanskrit work. They transported the concepts and tried to integrate into our Pali Theravadin way of looking at things. But actually, it's a Mahayanist concept. You all have grown up to Sunday schools, right? Although I never attended any Sunday school. Most of you have gone to Sunday school before. You have read the Jatakas. And they always talk about Bodhisatta, right? But when you look at the Pali Jatakas, the word Bodhisatta is not mentioned. And in our Nikaya, the Buddha called himself the Bodhisatta only on two or three occasions. When? He would say, monks, previously, when I was unenlightened, still a Bodhisatta, that was referring to his life as Siddhartha Gautama, before he became a Sammasambuddha, during this lifetime. He could also refer to his previous lifetime in Tusita. That also is a Bodhisatta. When the Bodhisatta deceased from the Tusita body and he descended into the womb, that he would use the word Bodhisatta. Not earlier than that. There were some stories, for example, the story of Gatikara. Have you heard the story of Gatikara? Gatikara was a potter and the chief disciple of Kassapa Buddha. Kassapa Buddha is the Buddha just before our Gautama Buddha. Now, Gatikara was an anagami. But he was a lay person. He was not a monk. At that time, he had a good friend by the name of Jyotipala, who was a Brahmin, and a very learned Brahmin. He knew the Vedas by heart and a bit snobbish. Gatikara was not a Brahmin, he was of a lower caste. So one fine day, Kassapa Buddha came to the vicinity, and so Gatikara approached his friend, Jyotipala, and said, "Friend, why not let's go and see Kassapa Buddha, the Sammasambuddha, the Arahant, a worthy one. It would be good to go and approach and associate with such a person." Then Jyotipala, the snobbish Brahmin, said, "Enough, friend. What have I got to do with that Bota head?" Jyotipala called the Kassapa Buddha Bota head, you know. So he says he didn't want to go. And then Gatikara tried to convince him to go, but still he wouldn't want to go. So finally, Gatikara said, "Okay, let's go for a dip." So they went to the riverside, take a bath. And then while at the riverside, Gatikara again tried to convince his friend to go and see Kassapa Buddha. And this time he took him by the hair. Now, India at that time, being a very caste-conscious country, it was very rude for a non-Brahmin to hold a Brahmin by the hair. And Jyotipala was shocked that his friend could do such a thing. Although they were very close friends, they respected their caste. And then he said, "Well, this Kassapa Buddha must be really something for Gatikara to transgress such a social norm." But he was wise enough to do that. I mean, he didn't give him a slap or what. He was wise enough to think that way. And he said, "Okay, if it comes to that, let's go see him." So they went to see Kassapa Buddha. When Jyotipala arrived in Kassapa Buddha's presence, he did not bow, whereas Gatikara bowed, paid respect, and sat on one side. He just went there, stood and nodded, and then exchanged greetings like he were a friend. And then Gatikara asked the Buddha to give a discourse. And Kassapa Buddha gave a gradual discourse. And at the end of the discourse, Jyotipala was so impressed that he decided to become a monk. But he didn't say that to the Buddha yet. After the discourse, they left. And as they were walking away, Jyotipala criticized Gatikara. He says, "Friend, you have been listening to such discourses for so long because you are the Buddha's disciple. And yet, how is it that you haven't thought of renouncing? For me, after listening to this course, I'm going to become a bhikkhu." Now, you must know that Jyotipala was a Putujana, he was a worldling, he's not enlightened. But Gatikara was really an Anagami. So why do you think, being an Anagami, why is it that he didn't want to become a monk? So Gatikara said, don't you know, friend, I have two old blind parents to take care of. That's why I cannot become a monk. So he was an Anagami, but because he had parental responsibilities, he remained a layperson. So Jyotipala in the end became a monk. And he practiced under Kassapa Buddha. Why did the Buddha tell the story? Because one day the Buddha and a congregation of monks were traveling through the forest, and then they reached a certain place, a little clearing, and the Buddha smiled. Venerable Ananda noticed the smile and asked the Buddha why. And then the Buddha told them the story. At the end of the story, he told the monks, monks, you might think that Jyotipala was somebody else, but it was none other than myself. So our Gautama Buddha was Jyotipala at that time, during Kassapa Buddha's time. And he was so snobbish that he called the Kassapa Buddha Bottahead. So even in that story, he did not refer to himself as a Bodhisattva. It was so close, it was just one Buddha before. He didn't refer to himself as a Bodhisattva. He said, it was me. He just said, I only. He didn't say Bodhisattva. He only referred to himself as a Bodhisattva in his present lifetime before he became a Sammasambuddha, and in his previous lifetime, just before he came down to earth. So this is also another concept that crept into Theravada Buddhism. And you can see the rudiments of Mahayana Buddhism inside there already. People are beginning to put in things and trying to justify what they put in with a lot of legends and stories. So you cannot blame what the Mahayanis are doing. They're doing the same thing, playing the same game. Even Theravadins also are just as bad. If you study the scriptures with an objective mind, you can see all these things creeping in. In the early Nikayas, when the Buddha talks about people's ability to get enlightened, he didn't use the word paramis. Nowadays, we use paramis. I don't have enough paramis. I meditate also, cannot get anywhere. I cannot do this, I cannot do that. We always blame it on parami. The Buddha did not blame it on parami. What did he blame it on? He blamed it on indriyas, spiritual faculties. When he talked about different types of progress, slow and difficult, or slow and easy, or fast and difficult, fast and easy sort of practice, he will blame it on spiritual faculties. What are our five spiritual faculties? Faith, effort, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. If these five spiritual faculties are immature in a person, then his practice will be slow. If a person has got a lot of lobha, dosa, and moha, a lot of kilesas, that will make his practice difficult. Because the kilesas create a lot of defilements in him, especially anger in his practice, then it makes it difficult. The Buddha also talked about punya. In Mahaparinibbana Sutta, Venerable Ananda was very sad because the Buddha was about to pass away. And then he confessed to the Buddha. He says, now I'm in a daze and I don't know what to do. I'm still a trainee. I haven't achieved arahant yet and my master is going to pass away. So the Buddha consoled him and said, Ananda, don't despair. You have done merits before in the past. Strive on and you will achieve liberation. So, you have to have punya, you have done merits before in the past, and your indriyas or spiritual faculties must be matured. Then only you can get enlightened. Having said what I said just now about the legendary character or origins of the Abhidhamma, does it mean that we don't have to study the Abhidhamma at all when we just chuck it away and say it's not Buddha words? It's still very useful. Although it is not a perfect model, it's a very useful model that has evolved through the centuries by elders, scholars, not only through intellectual, rational thinking, but also through experience. They have gone into meditation and with a powerful mind, they have tried to identify the different mental states that can be present. And they have come out with this model, which is sometimes very useful in explaining the apparent inconsistencies and contradictions in the Pitaka, right? But we must always look at it from that point of view. It's only a model of reality. It's not reality itself. And it may be wrong. So don't be dogmatic. As the Buddha says in Kalama Sutta, don't go merely by the scriptures. Even the scriptures also, you don't have to trust. You cannot trust because you don't know how accurate they are. They could have been tempered with after so many years. You all must have played the game before, right? You pass a message to one person and then somebody will pass on until the end. By the time it comes out, it's completely different. But the only difference is that here, in the early days, the monks recited everything together, which means that the possibility of wrong readings will be very, very much reduced. And it needs a collaboration or the conspiracy of 500 monks to change the text. Right, not the first 500 monks have to conspire to put the word Bodhisattva in, right? Then it became easier when the text was put into writing. When you put into writing already, anybody can change, right? Not? The scribe can mistake, and then when you copy, mistake until the word turn around until something else. For example, this is not Pali, Pali, this is Pali Chinese. For example, the word Arahang is Pali word. It has been translated into Chinese as Alohan. Right? Not from Alohan become Lohan. Lohan become Lohan Ko. Chinese don't have Arahang in their language, meh? I don't know why they translate from Arahang to Alohan. Then it has different connotations already. So you can imagine the sort of things happening when they preserve the teaching initially by oral tradition. No writing, everything was oral. You listen to the teacher and then you recite after him. So you can imagine a lot of things could have happened. So it's always important to bear this in mind, that although the Abhidhamma model created by the elders are useful in explaining many apparent inconsistencies, they are not the real thing. In order to find out the real thing, we have to study more suttas and meditate more. And not only meditate yourself, but also listen or discuss with other people. Listen to other people's experiences, discuss with people. If you just meditate, you only know your own experience. I think the best person to learn is the teacher. When the teacher teaches so many students and they come to report to him, he can know different people have got different experiences. Even though you give them a single subject to work on, different people will respond differently. It's just like a doctor. A doctor doesn't have to fall sick, right or not? Although he learns about drugs and how to diagnose people and how to treat people, it comes to experience how much you should give and what sort of symptoms, how they combine, and what sort of drugs work for what sort of people. So it's important for us to keep an open mind, not to disregard the Abhidhamma completely, nor to accept it as it is and say that that is the word of the Buddha and everything must conform to it. Not necessarily so. Okay, let me stop here for a while and let's have a discussion. Yes, anyone?
He was thinking that Kasapa Buddha time, he was already a bald-headed man.
Oh, Kasapa Buddha was bald-headed?
But during our
Buddha is not bald-headed.
He was not bald-headed at the time. And also his first monks following him in the beginning, they were not bald-headed. Then later on, they started with all the rulings and all that. They were asked to clean themselves up because there was a lot of talks about the monks don't present themselves well or something like that. And then it's about the time when they also shave off the hairs.
Mm-hmm.
But earlier, during the time when Samasam Buddha was around, in the beginning when he was enlightened, he was still bald-headed.
Oh, that's interesting. That brings us to the subject of the life of the Buddha. We have read Narada's book, Teaching to the Buddha, or many other books about the life of the Buddha. These are all based on commentaries and legends, you know, most of them. If you study the Nikayas, you should particularly study Venerable Nyanamoli's book called The Life of the Buddha According to the Pali Canon. It's quite different from what we know. There, the Buddha did not talk about seeing the four divine messengers. The sick person, the dead person, the old person, and the monk. He did not see. He thought about it. He reflected about it. He did not see. That one came from another story in Digha Nikaya Mahapadana Sutta. It's a great legend where the Buddha talked about the previous Buddhas before him. And in particular, he talked in detail about Vipassi Buddha. Vipassi Buddha saw the four divine messengers, but not our Gautama Bodhisattva. He did not see. And this story about the charioteer and then he using the sword to cut his hair and leaving his wife with the baby, all these things are not found. These are all spices added in later. If you read the Nyanamoli's book, you will see that there's very scant information on the life of the Buddha. He himself did not talk very much about it. These are all legends and fairy tales to make it sound interesting so that when you teach children, at least there's something to read about. There is one sutta called the Lakkhana Sutta where the Buddha talked about the characteristics of a great man. He talked about how the hair curls in certain directions and all that, and there's a bindu on his forehead. There's a description of a great man. But there's nowhere actually in the Pali Canon where it is said that the Buddha was not born. Recently, in our last introduction to Manghut program, there was a Punjabi who participated. He asked me the question, is it how come the Buddha has this bun on his head just like a Punjabi? Is he like a Sikh? So it's a artist's impression because there's something stated in the Lakkhana Sutta that the Buddha's head is different from people's head. It's sharp at the top or something like that. Now, when Venerable Sujiva went to India on a pilgrimage, he went to sit under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya. He meditated and he made a wish. He asked the devas around there. He says, if you had seen the Buddha when he was still around, please show me how it looks like. And then he had a vision while he was meditating. After that, he came back and immediately he painted. He's an artist. I think his drawing or his painting of the Buddha is still around in Kota Tinggi. And he also painted it in a book called Funny Monk's Tales. And there, you don't see the bun on his head. It's just the hair and the sharpened tip. So there's hair and it's sharpened like that. But he didn't do the curls. Maybe he didn't see the curls. So I find it very exciting now to discover a lot of things as I read the suttas. That many of the things that we have read or we know about Buddhism is not really truly from the Pali Canon. A lot of it comes from the commentaries, from legends, from what our teachers tell us and what their teachers tell them. Right? So I would encourage all of you, if you have time, to go through the Nikayas. The Majjhima Nikaya, the Sanghita Nikaya, especially a Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi's excellent translation. You can discover a lot of things, you know. a lot of things would show that what we know is not actually what the sutta say.
Vasiddhartha, a prince.
That's also another interesting thing. Vasiddhartha Gautama, a prince. He has been glorified that his father was a great king and he was a prince. It is not mentioned at all in the suttas. The sutta did not say that his father was a king. In fact, the Sakyans at that time were actually under King Kosala. And they were just a tribe. The chief of the tribe was a person by the name of Bhadra, I think. He became a monk later under Gautama Buddha. So actually he was just the son of someone who belonged to the ruling class, a Sakyan. He never referred to his father as Raja Suddhodana. He just said the Sakya Suddhodana. It's only the commentators, they glorify the Buddha. So, even to read the life of the Buddha according to the Pali Canon, very easy, you don't have to go searching here and then. You just buy the book called The Life of the Buddha According to the Pali Canon by Nyanamoli Thera. There, he states very clearly, this is from the Pali Canon, this is from the commentary. Then you can see what is from the Pali Canon and what has been added on, what are the spices.
Sante?
Yeah.
Was it mentioned in the suttas also that if a lay person becomes an arahant, if he doesn't go forth and renounce the lay life, then he will die? Why is it so?
It's not stated in the suttas also. This is what the commentaries say. Commentaries are also not agreed. Some commentaries say that 7 days. Some say 1 day. So they are not agreed. This is not in the suttas.
He will not be made as a lay person because he won't be able to fit in society or the lay life, right?
That sounds logical, but you look at Gatikara. Gatikara was an anagami. Anagami is one who has really cut off sensual desires, but he's still a layperson, taking care of his parents. But very strange, in the sutta, you read the Gatikara sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. He acted like a monk, he earned his livelihood like a monk, he never handled money. He would make pots and then leave it outside. But people want to give, they will exchange for him. And he never dig the ground to get his clay, because monks are not allowed to dig the ground. Very strange. You see, according to, again, the commentators, these Patimokkha rules are common to all Buddha dispensations. It's just a matter of to what extent. Some Buddhas give very detailed rules. Some just give very general rules. And also at the beginning of the Buddha's ministry, it seems that there were no rules. Because his early disciples were very spiritually matured people and they already knew the ascetic norm at that time. When the Sangha grew because of its popularity, then it attracted people with not so lofty motives. They were opportunists. They said, oh, I might not become a monk. Easy life, no need to work. You got a good place to stay, got good food to eat. So these are people infiltrated into the ranks of the Sangha. And their goal was not to strive for liberation. Their goal was just to get an easy life. So they misbehaved themselves, and then the monks and people complained to the Buddha, and then these rules were gradually set and increased through time. That's how the rules came about.
What's the difference between Vinaya and Patimokkha?
What's the difference between Vinaya and Patimokkha? Patimokkha is a set of major rules, whereas the Vinaya Pitaka is a whole set of rules and regulations for monks. So, Patimokkha is just a subset of the Vinaya. They are all together 5 books in the Vinaya, and the last one, it seems to be a very late edition. The first one is called Sutta Vibhanga, and Bhikkhuni Vibhanga, and then Chulawaga, Mahawaga. Then the first 2 books actually expand on the Patimokkha. Patimokkha is just the heading only. But in the Sutta Vibhanga, they will give you the origin story, how this rule came about. Somebody made a transgression, then the Buddha made this rule, then after that something else happened, and then the Buddha modified the rule, and then he will define each word, what this means. Finally, at the end, he will tell you what are the factors for committing this offense. When these factors are present, then it is what sort of offense. and when it is not an offense. So it's all very systematic in the analysis.
It's necessary for us to actually go through them so we don't actually commit any wrongdoing.
I don't think it's necessary for a layperson to go through the Vinaya Pitaka. There's one good book written by Venerable Ariyasako. That's good enough. Yes.
Is it true that monks are not supposed to handle items belonging to women? Not supposed to hold material and they're not supposed to touch as well?
Okay. Yeah, two questions. We'll deal with the second question easier. A monk is not allowed to touch a female woman or a girl even at birth with the lustful mind. If he has lustful mind, if he touched, then it's a grave offense. If he accidentally touched a woman, then there's no offense because there's no lust in his mind. Right? Now, if he were to touch a female animal with lust, then it's also an offense, but it's a minor offense. So, the important thing is lust in the mind. The monk has to check and see whether there's lust or not. But then the mind is very fast, it changes very fast. So that's why maybe in the Thai tradition, when women offer things to them, they don't accept directly. They have to put a piece of cloth there, maybe out of precaution, you know, so that you don't accidentally touch them and then lust arises, then you have to go through a process of purification. Now, touching women's belongings, this comes from one rule in the Patimokkha. It says that a monk is not allowed to touch jewels or what is considered jewels. Jewels means precious things or what is considered precious things. It is defined in the commentary that precious things are like gold, silver, gems, and so forth. Things that are supposed to be precious or regarded as precious are things that belong to people. So, a monk is not allowed to take these things. If he picks up these things, touches them, out of the monastery, it is an offense. Right? If, however, some people come to the monastery and then they drop some valuable item, maybe a gold watch or some notes or wallet, a monk is allowed to take that and keep it until the person comes to claim it. But outside the monastery, he's not supposed to do that because it's not his business. In the monastery, he's obliged to take it and keep it until the person comes to claim it. Then the commentaries goes on further to say, oh, not only this, he must also not touch other things as well, like things that belong to women and all that. But if it is something that belongs to women, but it is going to be made into something for the monk, for example, if a woman's clothing you give to a monk and then the monk is going to tear it apart and wash it and make it into a robe, then it's okay, right? In the early days, the monks used to go to the charnel ground and just take cloth from corpses, whether they are male or female corpses. Now, monks cannot get cloth from the corpses anymore because they don't wrap up corpses in white cloth anymore. But in the Thai tradition, I think they use white cloth to take back the ashes after cremating. And then these white cloths, they give back to the temple. Then some monks go and collect this to make robes. We have one whole stack in SPS, donated by the Thai temple.
I think it makes sense because I was in Kor, and they were burning the bodies. And before they burn the bodies, they cover the bodies with branches and stuff. They want to burn the body, and then they pull out the white cloth and they throw it in the river. And then you get people wading inside and actually collecting their cloth. As and when they are burning the corpse, you know, they just take.
But it's different in India at that time. They don't burn. In early India, they only burn people who are rich and royalties and monks. Whereas other people just throw it outside and let the jackals and the vultures take care of it. Organic disposal.
The question asked about a monk touching the women, and the emphasis is on the lustful mind. Then what about when they talk about not taking precious things or not touching precious things, do they talk about the mind also?
No.
As an emphasis?
You didn't say anything about that. That means it's not because you want to steal or what, no, you're not allowed to touch it. Cannot take it. Stealing is another matter. If you steal, it's a very grave offense.
Yeah.
It's another rule. So this one is not even allowed to touch it, to remove it from its place. Unless it's in the monastery. So it's not that it's a taboo for monks to touch money. Monks can touch money in the monastery if it belongs to somebody else and he's taking it to keep as a safekeeping, but not for himself.
One day you were speaking of lust in the mind. The monk may not have lust in the mind, but the other lay people would be seeing him touching a young girl or what, and then they
interpret his
intention.
Yeah.
So out of compassion for lay people, best for a monk, don't go and touch. Don't even pet a female animal, dog or cat. This is defined in the book of analysis. Even a newborn babe also not allowed to touch, I mean with lust. But it's better to keep out of it. There's one rule which says that a monk is not allowed to stay in an enclosed area with women without a knowledgeable man around. A knowledgeable man means a man who knows what is vulgar and what is not vulgar. If you have a group of women here and then you call a small boy and see here, he's not counted. He's not a knowledgeable man, right? Or you call a man here, but he doesn't understand what we are speaking. You call a Burmese here or Nepalese here, don't know what we are speaking, so cannot, right? In this rule also, there's one condition that a monk breaks this rule only if he has impure motives, that he wants privacy to speak in private with these women without anybody hearing. If he doesn't have such a motive in mind, then it's okay for him to sit in a room with women. But how would you know what's in his mind? And then people who know the rule will start to say bad things about this monk. So that's why some of our teachers are very strict on this. They don't allow a monk to sit with women in an enclosed area without a knowledgeable man around.
Can a lay person actually be brought to the community? Let's say this happens, a monk and a few women in an enclosure.
Uh-huh.
If nobody reports it, then it's
not fair. No, there's nothing to do with report. It is the state of mind of the monk. If he has impure motives, he wants to stay in privacy with women. And then he does so without the knowledgeable man around, then it's an offense for him. Right? But what I'm saying is that even if his motive is pure, he doesn't have that motive of wanting to stay in privacy. It is best not to be caught inside the situation. Not because somebody is going to report, but in case somebody sees and then they have the wrong impression, then they could create some bad karma for themselves. And also bad reputation for the monk.
If that is the case, then there's such thing as emails where you can go into chat in the computer.
Mm.
You can phone, you can telephone from this end to that end, you can speak.
Yeah.
So there will be new rules added to it.
You see, the Buddha gave us the four great standards in the Vinaya. Because the Buddha knew that he cannot give us a set of rules that are exhaustive. His conditions would change. And even during his time, the rules that he laid down were modified from time to time according to circumstances. So he gave us these four great standards. If there's something which I have not allowed, but it goes against what I've allowed, then you should consider it not allowable. If it's something that I've not allowed, but it accords with another rule which I've allowed, then it's allowable. There's another tool to twist it around, right? So things like glasses, watches, these things were not allowed by the Buddha. But we are wearing glasses now. We have watches, you know, although we don't wear like an ornament, we have watches to keep time, we have computers. But it's how you make use of it. It's just like fire. Fire is something immoral. You can make use of it in a good way or in a bad way. It's up to your moral conscience to do so. It can be abused, no doubt about it. Computer can be abused, internet can be abused. But it's also a very good way of communication. Like this Buddha net, the headmaster of Buddha net, Venerable Panyawaro, gets how many thousands of hits per day. Imagine how you can spread Buddhism faster nowadays through modern technology.
Reverend, we have read that after a high priest has been cremated, they used to find a lot of services depending on how well cultivated he is. The more cultivated he is, the more services they will find after the cremation. How far is that true?
Question is about relics, and it seems that when a monk dies and then is cremated, if relics can be found, some people believe that it is an indication of his level of attainment. So how far is that true? That's a good question. I just received a book just now which I haven't read yet. Somebody made a research on this. I haven't read it yet, so I don't know what it is. But frankly speaking, I don't really have any interest in relics. People give me relics, I just took like, they're just stones to me. I mean, I don't get any faith or inspiration out of relics. But I also heard that in Korea or in Japan, there's some crematoriums where they can adjust the temperatures in such a way that they can produce relics. One day, I think the first introduction to monkhood program, one of our participants, he found some things that looked like relics. And he started to tell everybody, hey, look at this, I found this fantastic relic. And everybody was so amazed and was very impressed. Finally, somebody asked him where he found it. He said, here, here, here. And then he found out that it was actually silica gel.
Jose, you mentioned in whatever scripture that after Buddha's cremation, they found this kind of
There's some mention about this in the commentaries, not in the suttas. Commentaries say that when one of the arahants passed away, then his dhatu, like pearls, were found. But I guess if you are attained to some extent, you can precondition your body depending on your level of attainment. I've seen some fantastic photographs of relics of Tibetan lamas, great practitioners. But how does that affect us? Whether they are attained or not, that's their business. Whether you are attained or not, that's more important. I can never get any inspiration from looking at relics, but I wonder why people are so excited by that. Can somebody share that with me?
I think based on one of the motivation for the lay people to practice more good deeds, maybe.
Are people motivated to practice, or are they there just for devotion? They pray at it and then they make a vow and say, oh, I pray to you, please give me good luck, or something like that.
Yes. Is it possible now, at this time, for lay people to be sotapanna?
That's also a big question, because what is a sotapanna? Nowadays, different people have got different definitions of what a sotapanna is. What entails enlightenment?
But see reality.
See reality to what extent? You see, that's the problem. In the scriptures, people who read the suttas and who don't read Visuddhimagga or who don't read the commentaries will not tell you that a sotapan is one who has perceived nibbana. Because when you read the suttas, they will give you a description of how a person gets the dhamma chakku, the dhamma eye. And the description is, yang kinci samudya dhammang sabangtang nirodha dhammang. Whatever has a nature of arising has a nature of cessation. He sees this and therefore he has attained the Dhamma. What does that mean? It could also mean rising and falling, you know. You see things arising and passing away, and so you are sotapanna already. So some people who read the suttas will claim that they are sotapannas because they see things arise and pass away.
You see everything, impermanence everywhere.
Oh, so you mean you're sotapanna already? There are also other factors, okay? A person has become a sotapan, has eradicated three fetters. What are they? Sakaya ditti, wrong view that there is a permanent self, alright? And then doubts about the Buddha, Dhamma Sangha, and then also believing that by following certain rites and rituals, it can be enlightened. people can also say that they have fulfilled these three. I got no doubts of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Secondly, I know they must meditate. No meditate, how to get enlightened? Okay. Thirdly, I got no wrong view. See, I know that I'm impermanent. So, the next thing is 5 precepts. That's the next test. Alright? Can you be absolutely sure that you have no thought at all to break the 5 precepts? Not to talk about actually breaking it. That is the real test. Why do we say that? The Buddha did not actually say this. The Buddha did not say directly that the Sotapan is certain in his 5 precepts. He's pure in his 5 precepts all the time. He didn't say that. He said that Sotapan is possessed of the sila that is cherished by Ariyas, noble ones. And he says that he is Vinipatika Dhamma. That means he does not fall into apaya anymore. Right? So it is by inference. Why is it that a person does not fall into apaya? What causes a person to fall into apaya, in the lower realms? Because you break the 5 precepts, right not? If you break the 5 precepts, you create the karmic potential to be reborn in apaya. But the Sotapan no more already. He won't be reborn in apaya. So, by inference, he should be pure in the 5 precepts. Whatever 5 precepts that he had broken before in the past become ahosikama, become defunct. You don't have any power over him to cause him to be reborn again. And he will not create any new potential to be reborn in the lower realms. Therefore, you can say that he is pure in the 5 precepts. Right? Now, look into it deeper. Musawada, telling a lie. There are certain conditions involved. One is that you know that something is untrue. And then there's an intention to deceive. You make the effort to deceive. And then somebody is deceived. And finally, he suffers a loss. Only if these 5 factors are present, will this precept be considered broken to such an extent that you create the karmic potential to be reborn in apaya. If one of these factors are not present, then it doesn't fulfill the thing. Which means that if it does not cause ruin to somebody, does not cause a loss to somebody, then you don't create the karma, right? So people can say, oh, Sotapan can tell a white lie, right? Because you don't hurt anybody. You don't cause a loss to somebody else. So there's a lot of possibilities for self-deception. If you want to make yourself a Sotapan, there are many ways that you can deceive yourself. And also there's an interesting thing that I just read yesterday when I was going through the first book of the Abhidhamma. They talk about certain things that can be abandoned through vision. Certain things that can be abandoned through bhavana. You know it's bhavana, right? Cultivation. So, dasanena bahitabha dhamma. And then, bhavanaya bahitabha dhamma. Bahitabha means to be abandoned. The dhammas to be abandoned by bhavana. The dhammas to be abandoned by dasana or vision. So, the first 3 factors are to be abandoned by vision, not bhavana. The bhavana are the higher factors. The factors that the Anagami and the Arahan eradicate. What are they? Sense desires and ill will are eradicated by the Anagami. And then Arahan, desire for rebirth in the Rupa realm and the Arupa realm for further existence, no more restlessness, no more pride, no more ignorance. The fetters to be abandoned by Anagami and the Arahata must be done through bhavana. Whereas for the Sotapan and the Sakadagami, it is through vision. So what is meant by vision? That's also another question, you see. What is meant by vision? What is meant by bhavana? So that's why I say it's not easy at this age now to determine who is a Sotapan or what are the factors of a Sotapana. You can go and look in the scriptures. The scriptures give you the factors of a Sotapana, the factors of a Sotapati, Pala, but they are not like what the Visuddhimagga or the Abhidhammata Sangha tells us. It's different.
So there's no way to gauge whether you are on the right path or wrong path?
The best way to gauge is to watch your own kilesa. Are you pure on the 5 precepts? How is your mental state? Do you still have lobha, dosa, moha? Has it been reduced through practice?
Do you need intellectual knowledge to know this?
You wouldn't need much. As I said, within one discourse, a person can get enlightened, can become a sotapan. How much intellectual knowledge do you need? It really depends on the individual. Some people, they might need a lot of intellectual knowledge in order to give them the faith or inspiration to accept Buddhism. After they accept, then only they can practice. Some people, by nature, have a lot of faith in them. They can get inspired or believe very easily. So for these people, no need to say it a lot.
In the Theravada tradition, you talk about these four stages. Does it happen in the Mahayana and the Tibetans tradition? Why I ask that is because I find this obsession on, okay, I've reached this, I'm here and there. I honestly believe myself that it is like a gradual development. So it is a gradual development. We're talking about steps rather than like a curve, you know, like you are developing along a curve rather than, okay, I reached this step. So that's why I'm curious, this obsession with Theravada, because we talk about these four stages. So thereby everybody says, oh, you know, this is an attainment. Do they talk about it in Mahayana's teachings? Do they talk about it in Tibetan?
I think they have even more stages. The Mahamudra has got many stages. And then the Mahayana, they have these different stages of Bodhisatta. After you finish your Arahata, you still got to go further up for more Bodhisatta levels.
Why do we talk about stages? I mean, if you talk about development and understanding the truth, does it have to be in stages, or is it something that you discard and you develop and understand?
There's two simile that was given by the Buddha. One is of a carpenter or a woodcutter. Carpenter or a woodcutter holds an axe in his hand. Now, he will not be able to know when the marks of his hand are imprinted onto the handle of his axe. After many years, you'll see, hey, how come my imprints are there? But he will not be able to tell you which day it started and how much it progressed. So the Buddha says, in the same way, in your meditation, it happens. It's a gradual eradication, right? But it's not only gradual. Next simile they give explains it further. He says it's just like a ship that sails the seven seas. As it sails the seven seas, it has all these ropes that anchor it to the pier. If it sails for a long time, then the ropes become worn out because of weathering, right? So one day after he has sailed already, he will stop for the rainy season. So you'll tie the thing to the pier and leave the ship there. Then, because the ropes are already weathered through so much travel and by the weather, one fine day, it will just break very easily. It's just the same for our practice. So it's both gradual and certain. You know what I mean? It's both gradual and certain. Gradually, until pop, then you really go to become an Arya. Okay, any more questions?
This hypnotism, they can regress the person to the earlier life and even to past lives. I've read books saying that.
Yes.
But never have I come across a book that says that while they go back to the past life, they will come across their animal life or other lives. Earlier lives as a human life only is mentioned. How to explain that?
I don't know how to explain that, but I've read some cases of patients who can remember a non-human life. Non-human life, you know, not necessarily an animal. This is an intermediate life between one human existence and another. And they are not a human and they don't have a name. And this was stumbled across by one psychiatrist. He was doing past life regression and he used the wrong words. Instead of saying, go back to your past human life, accidentally, he said, go back to your past existence. So he went back to his past existence as a non-human being. Then when he asked him, who are you? What's your name? He says, I have no name. He said, where are you now? He says, I'm nowhere in particular because he's in the intermediate state. One particular case that has imprinted in my mind is this person who says that now I have no name, but I'm in my mother's womb. And now I'm very worried. Then the hypnotist asked him, why are you worried? Because mom is going to draw water from the well and I'm afraid that she might hurt me. And then how do you know? He says, I'm outside looking in. So this intermediate being, sometimes inside the womb and sometimes outside. He can see the mother and what's happening. He called it inter-life, the life between one human existence and another. I also read some past life regression. We talk about animal lives very little compared to those who talk about human lives. And of course, people who meditate or people who have spontaneous recall of past lives, especially in Buddhist countries, they talk about animal lives as well. There's one interesting case of one of my friends in Burma, a brother monk, one of his relatives. The mother died and came back as the daughter's daughter. So the mother who became the daughter, when she was naughty, the mother would cane her, see? And then she would complain, "Since when I was your mother, I never cane you. Now you cane me." And then she would go and sulk in one corner. And then the mother would feel very bad and then would cane her again. Okay, any more questions?
Some people start meditation before they learn Abhidhamma. Some people start meditation after they learn Abhidhamma. And what we learn from the teacher very often, the teacher who also does meditation, say that, okay, if you understand Abhidhamma, when you meditate, whatever you experience, you can understand easily because you have learned the theory. But when they say that, don't reject totally Abhidhamma, but also don't depend on that. So actually, which one's more better, Bhante?
It really depends on the individual. The Buddha also, when he taught meditation subjects to people, sometimes he would teach them in detail, a lot of things to look at. Sometimes he would teach them very briefly. Because some people, they don't like details. Some people love details. If you give them too general things, they get fed up. They want to see more and more detail. Some people hate details. Give them too much details, they get fed up and they don't want to do it anymore. So it depends on the individual. Nowadays, Pahao meditation is very popular. And according to Pahao Sayadaw, what he teaches is according to the Visuddhimagga. And his meditators will have to develop the jhanas first. And then after that, study Abhidhamma. Study Abhidhamma, not the whole course immediately. After you get jhana already, then you will say, okay, now the next step is you're supposed to locate this. And these are the elements, and these are the characteristics of the elements. So you make use of your concentration to investigate into your body and to verify what you learn. So they do that step by step. They don't learn all their Abhidhamma first and then they meditate. You meditate first, you get a jhana, after that, you go step by step. Can you identify the Pathavi element, the earth element? After you can already, then you say, okay, now the next step you do is, can you identify the water element? Then he will tell you all the different characteristics, then you identify that. Then later on, you will go through the kalapas. Each kalapa has got minimum of 8 elements, right? So he will ask you, okay, now you have to look at the kalapas, because the kalapas, they are rising and passing away from moment to moment. You have to check each kalapa to see each of the elements inside there. Does this one have Pathavi? Does this one have Apo? Does this one have Tejo, Vayo, Oja, Ganda, Rasa, and Vanna? So, all these things you have to check. And then not only that, you must check and see whether the kalapa is Kamaja, Utuja, or Aharaja, or Chittaja. And then after that, you have to check other things as well. After you have checked that already, then you have to check your Bhavanga, you have to check your Chitta Viti, what sort of consciousness is there. He will teach you the Chitta Viti first. What are the consciousness involved in the thought process, different units of consciousness, and then you go and verify or locate that. Now, there are also some criticism regarding this method of practice. Why? Because it could be auto-suggestion. Right or not? Because when the mind is very powerful, it can create whatever you want to see. So those people who are very concentrated, they see all these things, they see for themselves. So of course to them it's very real and they believe wholeheartedly that this is the Dhamma. This is what is taught by the Buddha because they saw it what? They created it or what? Whereas, if it were actually natural Dhamma, ultimate reality that is, no matter you study or don't study, it is, then you don't have to study what? All you need to do is develop jhanas, look, can you see or don't see, you just report, and your teacher will be able to know whether you saw or don't see. Right? But there is another sutta called the Kingsukopama Sutta. I've already explained it in one of my CDs. It's called the Four Modes of Perfect Vision, right? Then there are different subjects of meditation. The sixth sense, base contacts, and then five aggregates, the four elements, and then whatever arises, passes away. So some people don't have to classify into the five aggregates, don't have to classify into the six sense bases. They just see whatever arises, pass away, so they can get enlightened. Some people have to go to very minute details. So it really depends on the individual, and there's no only one perfect method. If you're inclined towards a particular method, you like all the details, go ahead, do it. If you can't, it doesn't mean that you cannot get enlightened. There are other ways of doing it. So we must learn to be very, very open-minded and accommodating and encouraging to others. Even though somebody cannot meditate the same way that we do, if they find that they are doing better in another way, you should encourage them to do so. Okay, any more questions?
Some teachers suggest that you note your rising and falling to get the concentration. But some teachers say you follow the breath.
At the nose tip.
So is there a fixed method?
It all depends what you want to do. Now I want to use the word samatha, also very difficult. Because the word samatha used in the sutta and used in the Visuddhimagga may not be the same. And the word jhana used in the sutta and used in the Visuddhimagga may not be the same. Right? So let's talk about it from the orthodox point of view, which means it's the Visuddhimagga jhana and Visuddhimagga samatha. Easier to talk. If you want to get the Visuddhimagga jhana, then you have to do anapanasati here. By doing rising and falling, you may not be able to get the jhana. According to commentarial explanation. But from practical experience, people who do rising and falling also, while they are doing rising and falling, they can get nimitta. Just like as you're watching the breath here, you can get nimitta. Right? And the point is not to watch your breath to get jhana. You watch your breath in order to get the nimitta. And once the nimitta is there, you shift your attention from the breath to the nimitta. And that's where you get the Visuddhimagga jhana. Right? Same thing with rising and falling. As you watch rising and falling, if you have done kasina or concentration practices in the past life, then these colors and all these nimittas will come. Then you stop watching the rising and falling, you concentrate on the nimitta. Then you can also go into jhana. So both ways also can from the practical point of view. It depends on what you want to do. Anyone else? Alright. You want to share merits? Let's all do it together. Idam me nyati nam ho du sukira un tu nyatayo. Idam no nyati nam ho du sukira un tu nyatayo. Idam o nyati nam ho du sukira un tu nyatayo. Yettavada jammehi. Sambadam punya sambadam sabbe satta numodantu sabba sambadhi sitiya idam me punyam magaphala jnanasa paccayo hotu idam me punyam asavakkhayavam hotu idam me punyam Nibbanasa Vajayo Hotu Sa Sa Sa